From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie and welcome to Coast AM. Last hour of the program tonight, Joshua P. Warren's Paranormal Moment. Here's what's happening. Danish police made about 250 arrests in Copenhagen Wednesday as an organized demonstration against the UN climate talks converged on the Bella Center ahead of the crucial negotiations at the summit. Christina Larsen, who is a spokesperson for the Climate Justice Action Group, which organized the protest, told the media that police have used pepper spray and dogs to contain the protests. Around 3,000 activists convened at the two railway stations in that Danish capital and began their march towards the Bella Center, the scene of the climate talks. CJA is calling for activists to take over the conference for one day and transform it into a people's assembly. It appears that worldwide now, people are beginning to realize that this is not just a summit for climate change. It's a summit about control. It's a summit to take control of a one-world government. Alex Jones, Infowars.com, PrisonPlanet.com, continues to monitor this story for us. Alex, I got to tell you, I'm glad that the rest of the world is beginning to wake up about this summit.
Absolutely, and we've got George Soros and UN-funded groups. I'm all for free speech and all for rallying. At the G20 this year, the police were out of control in Pittsburgh, but I've watched the raw footage, hours of it today. They're trying to take over the conference. They're trying to force their way in. They're funded by the UN to make it look like the people want global government. The people want these taxes. They want this regulation. These activists are demanding that more of our industry be shut down than has already been shut down so the media can point at them and say, oh, look, the people want you to take action. When the truth is, polls are now close to 70%. Just a few months ago, it was 50-50 or thereabouts, depending on the poll, of people buying into man-made climate change. But now with ClimateGate, the internal emails, more documents coming out, more whistleblowers, the whole thing's imploding. And now we have Ban Ki-moon again today, David Rothschild today admitting, yes, this is global government. Only global government can save you. This is blowing up in their face because for decades, they denied they were setting up a world government. They denied they were setting up a carbon tax. Now they're doing a bait and switch and saying, oh, yes, we're doing it, but to save you. And so all the seeds you've planted, that I've planted, that many others have planted of truth, are now sprouting. And this conference is going to fail. They're going to agree to meet again in Mexico City next year, but they're not going to get the main treaty they wanted. The problem is, the president has said he's going to order the EPA to list carbon dioxide as a toxic waste that plants breathe, that humans exhale. And Schwarzenegger's announced, along with the UN, that mayors and governors of the planet are going to implement regionally, bypassing the national government. So the UN is trying to take over our local communities now because they can't ram this through at the international level. So we've got to watch that and fight that. So they're going to plan B right now, but we are beating them.
It's about time. Alex, thanks so much for that update, as you always do. Fine work. The Philippines' most active volcano spewed ash as high as 500 meters and burning rocks and mud a kilometer down its slopes on Wednesday, and volcanologists expect a major hazardous eruption soon. Yesterday, we had R.B. Trumbly on the program. He is a volcanologist. He predicted with a 52% possibility some time ago that this volcano, Mayon, would go. More than 20,000 people have been evacuated in the danger zone, so we'll keep our eyes on that. Iran has successfully test-fired an improved version of a medium-range missile. TV pictures show that the launch of the rocket, which experts say has the range now to be able to hit Israel and U.S. bases in the Gulf. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke has been named Time Magazine's Person of the Year for 2009. Last year's winner was then-President-elect Barack Obama. The 2007 winner was Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. Gerald Celente is the founder and director of the Trends Research Institute and is today's number one trend analyst. You know, he predicted this economic collapse way before anybody else. Gerald, what do you think of Ben getting the nod for Person of the Year from Time Magazine?
Well, first of all, Time magazine is just about a worthless magazine. How about Not in Time?
Or out of time, right?
Or out of time. It's just a little pamphlet these days. And secondly, when you look at Ben Bernanke's track record, you have to shake your head and wonder. On January 10th of 2008, as the nation was already in recession, Ben Bernanke told Congress, quote, "The Federal Reserve is not currently forecasting a recession." And then in April, as we're getting deeper into recession, he said, quote, "Recession is possible, but recession is a technical term. I'm not ready to say whether or not the U.S. economy will face such a situation." It's a joke. And if we had a track record as bad as Ben Bernanke's, we would have been laughed out of business 30 years ago.
We sure would. Gerald, what's new with the trends research?
Well, we're coming out with our top trends for 2010, and a synopsis will appear in After Dark magazine. And we're alerting people now to really be on high alert, because one of the top trends for 2010 is Terror 2010 and the crash of 2010. So things are looking pretty bleak, and as Alex Jones pointed out, there's a lot of people out there trying to control the situation toward this one world government.
Very good. Thanks, Gerald. Now, next Wednesday, Linda Moulton Howe will be with us for her monthly series of reports. We've moved her up because of the holidays. One of her segments will be a very lengthy interview with Gerald Celente, so make sure you listen in. In Wilmington, North Carolina, authorities are investigating why the body of an 88-year-old woman lay in her bed for up to 8 months, even though the caretakers visited the house every day. Sheriff's deputies say the corpse of Blanche Matilda Roth was found in her home after a call to 911. Roth likely died in May. Can you believe that? In Hayward, California, picture this for a moment. You go out and get your child a cell phone. You want them to text and enjoy themselves. Not use it too much, because we don't know about its health causes yet, and hazards. But you go out and get your kid a cell phone. You're happy with it. You know it's going to cost you a little bit. That second line, sometimes $9.95, a little bit more. You get the bill. Well, a 13-year-old teen is in hot water with his father after running up a cell phone bill of nearly $22,000. He said he was expecting his bill, according to the dad, to be higher this month after adding his son to the plan. But, well, he wasn't expecting a bill of $22,000 in data usage charges. The Hayward man said his Verizon wireless bill soared after his son apparently downloaded, get this, 1.4 million kilobytes of data last month. Up next, Nick Redfern joins us. We talk about the alien and human interaction. This is an incredible story, and Nick Redfern has it next on Coast to Coast AM. British ufologist and cryptozoologist Nick Redfern is the author of many books, his latest, Contactees. He is an expert in the paranormal, conspiracy theories, UFOs as well. Nick writes regularly for UFO Magazine, Fate Magazine, and others, and has uncovered thousands and thousands of pages of previously classified Royal Air Force, Air Ministry, and Ministry of Defense files on UFOs. Nick has been interested in UFOs since 1978. 31 years, Nick. What got you interested in UFOs, my friend?
Well, actually, George, it was my father. He worked in the British Royal Air Force on radar and was actually involved in several significant incidents in the early 1950s when very fast-moving unknown targets were tracked flying over the English North Sea. And, of course, the first thought was, could it be some sort of Russian sneak attack? And this was despite the fact that, you know, these objects were traveling at fantastic speeds. And so aircraft were scrambled from a nearby Air Force base. The pilots couldn't even get anywhere close to whatever these objects were. And this actually went on for two or three nights. And at the end of the encounters, everybody involved, from the pilots down to the ground crew and the radar personnel, were told not to talk about the incident. And my dad didn't tell me until I was like 11 years old, 12 years old, something like that, in the late 70s. And it really, I suppose, his home, but here was someone, you know, that I knew and trusted, obviously my own father, but equally someone trained in the military on radar, but talking about UFOs, and that's what really kicked off my interest, if you like.
Now tell us about the latest work, Contactees.
Well, Contactees, as you can probably guess from its title, is a study of the many people throughout the UFO field of research and history, if you like, who have claimed contact, close encounters with very human-like aliens. You know, people such as going back to the era of George Adamski, right up to the present day. Now, of course, you know, within the UFO field today, we hear a lot about abductions, I guess kidnappings, for want of a better term. The contactees were a little different in the sense that they had quite open interactions with purported alien beings. And I found that, unfortunately, you know, the UFO subject tends to have a short memory. And a lot of people within the field today, and particularly those new to it, aren't necessarily aware of this pretty significant aspect of the whole UFO field. So I thought it was kind of time to, I guess, redress the balance a little bit and bring some of these old stories forward and see if we can really try and get to the bottom of what lies at the heart of the contactee mystery.
You know, Nick, you've got to be disappointed with the decision by the Ministry of Defense for shutting down its UFO files and hotline just recently.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of like a strange story because, as I've pointed out to people in various blog posts I've made since this story first surfaced a week or so ago, the oddest thing, of course, is that if, say, for example, British Royal Air Force bases within the British Isles track unknown objects flying towards the UK, they're going to investigate them because, by definition, they have to. Now, some of those incidents may well remain unidentified. It doesn't mean they're extraterrestrial craft, but they are inevitably going to remain unidentified. So in that respect, the government will still be, by definition, investigating UFOs. You know, it would be absurd to imagine, for example, if the US military said we're never going to investigate UFOs again, but then decided never every time there was a spurious or an unknown radar report to say, oh, well, this is obviously UFO, we'll ignore it. You know, no government would be foolish enough to do that. So in that respect, they're obviously going to continue to look at those reports. I suspect what they're trying to do, for whatever purpose, is avoid having to deal with the general public sending in reports of their own encounters. Now, whether that's because they feel, you know, that they've got the information they need already, I think that's a distinct possibility. We just don't know. But certainly, you know, in terms of having a valuable outlet for the public to turn to, it's a big tragedy that they've decided to close their doors, you know, on the taxpayer who's basically Absolutely. Keeping them in their jobs.
And I wonder what other countries will start following suit again after I thought they were starting to release all these reports. You know, it's very disappointing.
Yeah. Well, that's the unfortunate thing, you know, one seems to follow suit from the other.
Yeah, absolutely. Tonight, special three-hour report with you about contactees. Let's get your definition of what you believe a contactee is.
Okay. Well, essentially, the contactees, how they differ from today's abductees, because this is an important factor. I suppose many people who report the abduction scenario talk about being forcibly taken on board craft, subjected to medical experimentation, and some sort of mind manipulation to where, to a significant degree at least, the memories of the event are wiped clean from their mind. The contactees, who largely began to surface in the late 40s and early 50s, were in a very different mode to that, I suppose, is the best way to term it. They claimed very close encounters at, for example, desert locations, mountains, forests, in other words, isolated places, but locations where they felt compelled to go out. It wasn't, you know, as if they were forcibly taken there. They felt compelled for reasons they didn't really understand to go to these places and were met or confronted by classic flying saucer-type craft that would come down and were reportedly crewed by very human-looking aliens, very often described as having heads of long blonde hair, and for want of a better term, you know, they could pass amongst us pretty much as human, and they would, I guess, you know, discuss the perils of nuclear war and how we need to live in peace and harmony with one another, and they encouraged the contactees, as these people became known, to go out and spread the cosmic word, if you like, and in that respect, you know, they were almost, I suppose, acting as a mouthpiece, allegedly, for the aliens and getting their philosophy out there.
And this has been going on since almost the beginning of time, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. I mean, you know, the whole contact era, as we know it in ufology today, pretty much kicked off in the late 40s. But, you know, as I point out in the book, that the issue of, I guess, encounters in remote locations with higher beings has been going on since as long as people have been able to, you know, talk or write the written word and pass stories down. I think it's more the interpretation in the past that perhaps put, you know, the spin that was put on it that obviously wasn't a UFO spin. Today it is. So, yeah, we can go back, you know, thousands of years, arguably, and see parallels with ancient encounters compared to those of the modern era.
Now, tell us a little bit about the contactee, George Adamski, and I want your take on him.
Yeah, George Adamski is without doubt, you know, the ultimate contactee. He's the person who, regardless of to what extent people are, I guess, knowledgeable or not of the contactee movement, he's the one person more than anybody else that everybody identifies with. And George Adamski was a Polish man who, at the age of two, moved with his family from Poland to the United States. And throughout the 20s, 30s, and 40s, he had various different jobs around the U.S. And in the mid-1930s, he set up an organization called the Royal Order of Tibet, which was essentially, I guess, like an alternative, or taught an alternative spiritual way of life. So in other words, he was already, I guess, embedded in, you know, the sort of New Age beliefs and philosophies, as we might term them today, but long before his purported UFO experiences. Now, in terms of UFOs, things, according to Adamski, pretty much kicked off in the late 40s when he had a number of significant UFO sightings out in the California desert, which came to a head in 1952 when, along with another contactee, a man named George Hunt Williamson, and a couple of other friends and their wives, he was out in the desert, again, like so many of the other contactees, felt compelled to go to a particular location, not really understanding why he was feeling that way and feeling compelled to go out there, but reported seeing this classic 1950s-style flying saucer come down, which had like a tripod undercarriage to it, and this very human alien who apparently went by the name of Orthon departed from the craft. There was, I guess, like a communing of minds and theories and ideas where, for example, this alien being again reportedly discussed the whole issue of atomic warfare, the perils that faced humankind in the future if we didn't change our ways, etc. And like so many who came after him, George Adamski suddenly, I guess quite literally out of the blue, felt the need and the compulsion to go out there and tell people what he reportedly had seen, had experienced, and what these aliens had told him. And certainly it seemed to pay off because his first book that was published in 1953, co-authored with an Irishman named Desmond Leslie, sold in excess of 125,000 in its first printing, 125,000 copies.
And in those days, that's a lot.
Oh, that's a lot. You know, I mean, today's UFO books, you don't see anywhere near that sort of scale for the most part in terms of copies sold. So in other words, Adamski, although, you know, he was someone who'd literally just come from nowhere, he was really thrust into the ufological front pages, if you like, and his book certainly attracted a huge audience and, more importantly, followers. This is one of the big things with the contactees like Adamski, that they attracted a following rather than just casual readers. And Adamski claimed a number of other encounters throughout the years, wrote a number of books altogether, and stood by his accounts of meeting these very sort of wise, advanced, human-like aliens to his dying day in 1965. And as I said, he really defined the contactee movement, and probably without Adamski, you know, a lot of these other people probably wouldn't have reported their encounters for fear of ridicule, etc.
All right, more to come on Coast to Coast AM with our special guest tonight, Nick Redfern. We'll be right back. Had a great time today. I was live at the St. Louis, the city of their television network, live audience, had a great time. We were talking about Coast to Coast AM and Journey to the Light, our book, which is now available via Barnes & Noble and Macmillan and Amazon.com. All those links you'll find at coasttocoastam.com. If you want to read about some of these incredible stories sent in by Coast to Coast listeners, Journey to the Light by Bill Burns and a little bit of me on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Nick, how would you rate George Adamski's authenticity?
Well, you know, this is one of the big questions about the contactees. To what extent, you know, they were being truthful or not. And you know, I've tried in the book to treat the subject honestly and objectively. And my personal view is that, like a lot of the contactees, I do actually believe, based on a deep study and an analysis of the evidence, that George Adamski actually did have several, I guess, life-changing experiences with some sort of intelligence that interacted with him. I suspect that what happened, however, that like as with some of the others, that the initial experiences may well have dried up, and that unfortunately he went down the wrong path of continuing to promote the message of the Space Brothers by creating bogus stories. And I think, unfortunately for many people, what happened then, of course, is that the good stuff gets thrown out with the bad. But I do actually believe that, like a lot of them, he did have an initial core experience that sent him down this road.
Next up, George Van Tassel. Mm-hmm. What do we know about George?
Well, another George. For some weird reason, a lot of the contactees were named George, but I don't know why.
Maybe including me, you never know.
There you go. But George Van Tassel, I guess, in popularity stakes, was certainly right up there with George Adamski. He was a little different from Adamski in the sense that Van Tassel lived out at a town called Landers in California in the desert. And he felt, again, like Adamski, compelled one night to basically camp out under the desert's moon and stars and claim that in some sort of like an astral or out-of-body form, he was taken on board a UFO. So it wasn't like a physical abduction or contact in the first experience. But after this initial astral encounter, he claimed that on a number of occasions in the desert outside of Landers, that he met with these classic human-like aliens that became known as the Space Brothers. And like Adamski's and so many others, Van Tassel's had the now familiar long blonde hair, one-piece uniforms, very much like a ski suit, and could pretty much pass for human beings. And where Adamski and Van Tassel differed, I suppose, is that Van Tassel pretty much was, I guess, sent down a path of putting on conferences. He was encouraged to spread the word through the medium of organizing yearly events, getting the big names in the contactee movement to speak at these conferences, which were all actually open-air events in the desert. And in the same way that George Adamski's book sold an incredible 120,000-plus copies, in the same fashion, at the height of his conferences out in the desert, Van Tassel was actually attracting audiences in excess of 12,000, which, you know, in terms of a UFO conference today is completely unheard of. So, again, this was one of the reasons why the contactees were so important and significant, that they did galvanize change and followings. Now, the big thing that Van Tassel said his alien contacts suggested to him that he do was to construct a building that became known as the Integratron. And the Integratron can still be found in Landers today. Basically, what it is like a two-story building that looks pretty much like an astronomical observatory, like a domed white building, split into two levels. And the idea that was given to, or the instructions given to Van Tassel, were that this would be a building that would have the ability to rejuvenate human body cells and by definition extend the human lifespan. Now, unfortunately, Van Tassel died before the completion of the Integratron was put into place, but certainly the building was constructed, and you can go there now and take part in meditations and hear lectures, etc. And it's, you know, it's sort of like a cool kind of communal place. But Van Tassel's accounts were, you know, classic Space Brother type experiences, many encounters in the desert, Even, for example, you know, other witnesses present, which is kind of significant. Some of these cases are a single witness events, but Van Tassel's actually wasn't. So he was right up there with Adamski.
And again, authenticity about him. What do you think?
Oh, I actually think if you look at Van Tassel's experiences and you parallel them with so many other encounters throughout history with higher beings that seem to want to provoke change at an individual and collective level, and who seem to, I guess, you know, suddenly stumble out of the ether, so to speak, I actually think Van Tassel, again, did have interactions with some sort of higher entities. Where I differ from a lot of research is that I don't take the message from the so-called Space Brothers at face value that they were from Mars and Venus, as they claimed back in the 50s. I think they were very careful to protect their original points of origin. And, you know, when it's become pretty much clear that there probably isn't, you know, any high degree of intelligent life on Venus, of course, these stories get dismissed. But I think we have to look at the possibility that some sort of protective deception was in place, which did have an effect on the credibility of some of the contactees because of what they were saying. But we have to look at it from each aspect. So I think, you know, Van Tassel did have some genuine experiences, but it was tinged with deception on the intelligence's part, which, for some people at least, question the credibility of the encounters.
Why do you think the FBI looked at both Adamski and Van Tassel, Nick?
Yeah,
what did they want?
This is one of the most significant aspects of the contactee movement and shows its sheer strength and its ability to provoke change, because it attracted the deep attention and concerns of the U.S. government. You know, there probably aren't many people in the UFO subject today who can say, like George Van Tassel, that they were the subject of a 400-page FBI surveillance file. You know, these people have been dismissed, as I said, you know, by so many people in the UFO field today, quite unjustly, as having no significance. But when you're selling X number of books, get 12,000 people at your conference, and you're attracting the FBI's attention, you're doing something significant. And as far as your question's concerned, it's quite clear from the files that have been declassified by the FBI on Adamski, Van Tassel, other contactees like George Hunt Williamson, that the FBI's primary concerns were relative to the political aspects of the contactee stories. For example, it may come as a surprise to some people to know that in 1953, the FBI actually dispatched two of its agents out to George Van Tassel's home quite openly and went there and said, you know, can we speak to you about your experiences? And Van Tassel, of course, was delighted that he was getting an audience from the FBI and invited them into his home. And it's interesting from reading the now declassified files that the FBI weren't there to, I guess, threaten him into silence or ridicule his encounters. They asked sort of deep and probing questions relative to the nature of the so-called Space Brothers government, for example. You know, did they have sort of a communist-style government, a socialist-type government, or were they, you know, more inclined with Western-style ideologies in terms of government? They wanted to know to what extent the human race was being influenced or could be influenced by these beings. And extensive detailed reports were prepared by the FBI on Van Tassel. They even, as the files reflect, sent agents out in plain clothes, you know, jeans, T-shirts, to mingle with the audiences at conferences just to listen to the feedback that the lectures were provoking. And that's also the same with George Adamski. His FBI file runs to almost 100 pages. And again, there are references to the FBI even monitoring lectures that Adamski gave as far away as New Zealand and getting reports sent to them via the State Department office in New Zealand. So, in other words, not only were the contactees being watched on a worldwide scale, but they were being watched in a fashion that was ironically paralleling what a lot of the people in the UFO community were asking: where are these beings from? What do they want? What type of governments do they have? So in that respect, you know, this wasn't a debunking exercise. It seemed almost that the FBI were deeply concerned and may even had insider knowledge that there were, I guess, human-like aliens moving amongst us and possibly, you know, even infiltrating our infrastructure.
Interesting. And it seems like this interest in these people and others must have created a file that has got to be somewhere, right?
Yes. I mean, the important thing is that at least in the case of several of the contactees, the Freedom of Information Act has opened up their files. And in the book, I actually reproduce a number of these files. As I said, George Van Tassel's file was about 400 pages, and I managed to get the entire file from the FBI. Adamski's was nearly 100. Daniel Fry, who was a very early contactee, who claimed while he was working at the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico to have had, a classic contactee experience and been taken on board a craft, and I got hold of his FBI file. Dr. Frank Strange's, a man who died actually not too long ago, and who claimed that, again, human-like aliens were, I guess, infiltrating and within the government. I got his FBI file. So what I found, something that surprised me, is that it seems if you're a contactee, rather than, you know, in another field of the UFO, of UFO research, you are more likely to be watched by the government if you were making contactee-type claims. It was something that the government actually didn't steer away from. It, arguably, they came to it, you know, like a moth to the flame, so to speak.
Was it difficult for you, or did it take time to get all the information for the book, Contactees?
Yes, I mean, because I think one of the reasons being that the contactee stories are so, in many respects, they're old, so that makes it difficult in some respects, because one of the things I was determined to do in writing the book was that I didn't just want to go over old ground and pull, you know, 50 words from this book, 100 from that, because you're cheating your audience, I think, if you do just do that. So what I wanted to do was to speak to the very few still surviving people within the contactee field from the early years and the early researchers who are still around who'd met some of the contactees. People like, for example, Jim Moseley, who actually met George Adamski. So I interviewed Jim for the book, and I felt that was important. But, you know, it's difficult to find many people from that period. Then, of course, it was the issue also of pressing the FBI to release their files. And of course, you know, trying to go back with a fresh, open mind and analyze these old cases again and see what we can learn from them, see if we can finally answer some of the questions as to what lay at the heart of these experiences. So it was pretty much like a history tour for me in many respects, you know, going back a long, long time and just following up any still surviving leads.
Tell us about Truman Bethurum.
Yeah, Truman Bethurum is probably one of the most, if not the, but certainly one of the most controversial characters within the whole contactee field. He was actually a road construction worker who in 1952 was working near a place called Mormon Mesa in Nevada, and claimed a number of repeated experiences with flying saucers and human-like extraterrestrials in the summer and through the late summer of 1952. Now, Bethurum's story is actually being retold. He wrote altogether about five or six books, again, felt prompted by the aliens, so to speak, to do this. But his initial encounter occurred late one night when he'd gone up on the mesa and was looking for fossils. His wife collected fossils, and he was up there looking for some flora, and said this huge flying saucer came down out of the sky, somewhere in the region of like 300 feet in diameter, which, if you read his book, it sounds almost like something straight out of the day the Earth stood still, this huge source, ominous-looking saucer coming down. And Bethurum's story was a little bit different in the sense that he said the aliens that he saw that came out of his craft were human-like, but were smaller than us, maybe about 5 feet tall, wearing uniforms and peak-like caps. And he claimed that the ship itself had a space captain named Aura Raines, who was a beautiful woman. And now, of course, you know, this is where the story gets highly controversial, because it almost turns into like a a cosmic Romeo and Juliet or something like that. And of course, you know, I fully recognize that there are many people who were as detractors of Bethlehem's story as there were believers. It is a story that stretches credibility to its absolute max. But again, if you look at it, you know, it's very, very similar to people throughout history who, again, have claimed contact with, I guess, beautiful advanced beings from other worlds. But Bethlehem interpreted it in an alien situation. And he said he had 7 or 8 encounters with these beings out in the desert, usually late at night. And interestingly, he said they would generally identify themselves by firing a flare into the sky, like a very unconventional fashion, and then he would go out to the location and they would be there on the desert floor late at night waiting for him. And again, there would be a lot of discussion about the alleged nature of the alien world, their philosophy, their belief systems, their religions, basically their entire society and how we could learn from them. And for Bethlehem, at least, he described as pretty much being a learning process. And by his own admission, if you read his book and, you know, for people who accept his story, he became, I guess, overly obsessed with this space woman, Captain Aura Raines, to the point where, you know, his life had no real meaning beyond her. And he does come across like someone who was almost like magically entranced by this superior being. And as I said, he went on to form his own organization, wrote and published a number of books on his claimed experiences. The most interesting thing for me about Bethlehem is that he claimed that in 1953, he had a number of alien experiences near the town of Kingman, Arizona. What's interesting is that perhaps 20 years after Bethlehem's experiences, stories started to surface about a UFO crash near Kingman, Arizona.
Interesting.
With beings very similar to those that he described seeing. And yet he, I guess, came 20 years, as I said, before this story surfaced. So, in other words, if this wasn't an incredible coincidence, it seems that Bethlehem actually did have genuine experiences and had some sort of insider knowledge of this Kingman event. So, again, there's far more that meets the initial eye, if you like, to Bethlehem's story than the detractors would have us believe.
You sent us some images that we have posted at coasttocoastam.com. Mm-hmm. And, of course, one was the Integratron.
Yes.
That was constructed by Van Tassel.
Mm.
And it was supposed to be his rejuvenation machine. Did it work for him?
Well, you know, unfortunately, and rather ironically, he died of old age before he could finish it. He died when he was just before his 70s, I think, in around about 1978. But, I mean, Van Tassel was a very, very intelligent man. He used to work for Hughes Aircraft. He was a close friend, actually, of none other than Howard Hughes. And the interesting thing about the Integratron is that it was built without the benefit of nuts, bolts, nails, screws, etc. It's kind of like a Chinese-type puzzle. It's made up of interlocking parts. And, you know, for someone to design a two-story building that is held together by interlocking parts and made of wood, you know, implies a pretty, you know, strong, intelligent mind. This man was certainly no fool. And interesting enough, his FBI file actually reports that when he was employed at Hughes Aircraft, he actually helped the FBI on a number of security investigations. So again, you know, this was a highly intelligent man, deeply, I guess, intelligent and evolved, yet telling a very controversial story. And now, of course, you know, today people go to the Integratron. It's kind of like a pilgrimage for many people who adhere to the Space Brother contactee beliefs. And, you know, I've been there now several occasions, and it's, you know, an interesting, almost like a eerie experience to go there. You do kind of get this unusual otherworldly vibe that you are being exposed to something spiritual and non-earthly.
All right, stay with us. More with Nick Redfern on Coast to Coast AM.